Some politicians can shape their legacy. Miami-Dade's mayor is someone whose administration is being shaped by events. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Daniela Levine-Cava had plans on fighting COVID, gun violence, and affordable housing. But just a few months into her administration, she's dealing with the Surfside tragedy, Haiti, and Cuba. How has the mayor had to pivot to deal with the challenges? Also, a new Sun Sentinel investigation looks into the lack of oversight in South Florida's condo market. Will the Surfside tragedy change that? And finally, at any point, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of teens who are homeless in South Florida. We're going to meet a group trying to help these kids find a home. All of that today on Sundial, after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us today. 3 weeks after the Surfside condo collapse, search crews are still in the rubble looking to recover remains of victims and make identifications. Still, progress is being made despite the weather delays. 97 people are confirmed dead. 7 of those still haven't been identified. And there's still a list of 8 people potentially unaccounted for. Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava joins us now to talk about where things are today at Surfside. We're also going to discuss other issues that the county is dealing with right now, like COVID-19 and, of course, the situation in the Caribbean. Mayor Levine-Cava, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Lewis, for having me.
Mayor, what's the latest on the recovery efforts? I mean, how many crews are out there? How much time are they putting in daily? What kind of reports do you get regularly?
Yes, so we have still 2 of our USAR teams, that's Urban Search and Rescue. It's the local ones, Miami-Dade and Miami-Miami Beach. So there are 40 individuals on each shift. The shifts are from 7 to 7, so we're working 24/7.
Is there a timeline on when this site's going to get cleared out?
We don't have a timeline because we just don't know for sure how long it will take. And right now we are having to contend with a lot of water on the site. So there's a lot of dewatering, they call it, to make sure they can get access to the remaining part of the pile.
One of the challenges, too, right now is the issue with COVID. And I want to talk about that. COVID-19 now increasing again the number of cases in the county. But let's start with at Surfside. We've had a number of positive tests from the site. And Miami-Dade County Commission Chairman Jose Pepe Diaz and his aide tested positive. Can you give us any news as to how, what's going on right now with these positive tests? And is there any effort to make sure that the site is secure and that people are safe out there?
Yes. Yeah, so we had a lot of visiting rescue teams. And the outbreak was really confined to a few of those teams. And they were all treated. They were, of course, tested. Contact tracing was accomplished. And all of those teams have now moved off site. So we're not necessarily seeing that this is an outbreak in the community per se. I think it was more so isolated in those teams. But we do have an uptick throughout the state and the county. We definitely have a higher positivity rate, more testing, and we are going to be recommending that everybody go back to masking because, look, the most important thing is to be vaccinated, but we do know you can still contract the disease even if vaccinated. And the best news is that if you're vaccinated, you're very much less likely to get seriously ill, but we still need to protect each other, and masking is still the way to go.
So are you recommending everyone in the county go back to wearing a mask?
I'm recommending it for our county employees. And in general, yes, I'm recommending it, except with people that you know are safe, in your small family groups or those that you know have tested negative, that sort of a thing. But I'm not mandating it. I'm recommending it.
I see. I want to get to COVID here in a moment, but back to the Surfside issue. What role is the county playing in this investigation? I know it could take the investigation could take years.
Yes. So all of the evidence on the scene is being gathered by our Miami-Dade Police Department. It's being cataloged, sorted. It's going to be warehoused. Along with us is the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, a national team that did the 9/11 investigation, for example. They are working alongside, and our state attorney has asked the grand jury to take up the investigation, which they've agreed to do. So we'll be running parallel investigations.
Again, talking with Miami-Dade Mayor, County Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava about the latest developments on the site at the Surfside condo collapse. The death toll again now at 94, 22 people still potentially missing. You can find the latest on Surfside on our social media at WLRN Sundial. I want to turn the conversation now over to a couple other big issues, here in South Florida. And I know these are international stories, Mayor, but it has a profound impact on us here in Miami-Dade. You have the issue of the protest in Cuba and, of course, the assassination of the Haitian president. I wondered, have you spoken with the state, with state leaders, with the governor, or with the Biden administration about how those stories are impacting your residents?
Yeah, actually, Lewis, we have. And, you know, the governor is on site here today in Surfside. We had, as part of our morning briefing, an update from Homeland Security about whether there would be any migration from these countries. And so far, no, things are stable. But as far as supporting the Cuban and the Haitian people, we are with them. These are our brothers and sisters, our neighbors, our friends, co-workers, and it hits really hard for us here at home, the challenges in those countries. And we are standing united with the Cubans on the island who are speaking up, mostly for the first time. It is a historic juncture in their struggle for freedom and dignity and human rights. So all of the people coming out in support is very heartwarming, and I know is really encouraging to those in Cuba, and we laud their bravery as they are pushing for a free Cuba. As far as Haiti, we want our Haitian neighbors to be safe. We're very concerned about how this will all play out. And of course, we stand with our Haitian community members and are grateful that TPS has been granted, and we're working hard to make sure that they and Venezuelans who are eligible apply for that critical safety net here in this country as well.
And again, as I mentioned, I mean, these are international stories. There's a lot of there are calls for the Biden administration to take more action on
yes.
both Haiti and Cuba. But what role can you play? What role does the local government play in something like this?
Yeah, so we've been in touch with the White House. We've been keeping them abreast of what's happening in the community and asking them for a response to help with things like the internet access. Look, everybody's calling for communication so people on the island can continue to exercise their rights, but communication with their loved ones here in the United States. They're terribly worried and concerned about how their family and friends are doing in Cuba, and so the internet is a key part of that. Yesterday, I was part of a roundtable that Senator Annette Tadeo, Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and I convened. We met with leaders from the Cuban community to hear directly from them and have their messages directly go to the White House through this, through our ability to share their concerns. And they have a series of direct humanitarian aid they're calling for, as well as the internet connectivity.
Were there any other groups representing activists, you know, on the ground in Cuba as part of that roundtable discussion yesterday?
Yes, yes. It was quite a few organizations. We had Cuba. I'm going to pull up the list for you while we're still talking so I can make sure I'm accurate. But it was a group of about 8 organizations that are all very much at the forefront of communicating and putting together recommendations.
Yeah.
So here they are. I can tell you right now. We had Cuba Decide. We had the Cuban American National Foundation, the Cuban Democratic Directorate, and some individual activists who are very well known in this work as well.
All right. Thank you for clarifying that for us. And you know, again, because we have so much happening here, the other story, as you've been mentioning, is the Haiti story and, you know, our links to that, of course. And I'm wondering, what kind of conversations are you having with the Haitian diaspora about, you know, again, the instability in their country and how that's affecting people here?
Yeah, well, like I said, TPS or temporary protective status is something that we have been pushing for, and we're grateful that the Biden administration has approved it. We're going to be supporting groups on the ground that are getting people qualified for that status. We also, you know, want to be sure that the people in Haiti are safe. And, you know, at this juncture, I know a delegation has gone from the White House to Haiti, and we stand with them, not only because of the family and diaspora here, but because of the risks. Nothing more fundamental than assuring the safety. And recently we saw that COVID vaccines are finally going to Haiti. So I think that's a very good start.
You know, many Cuban Americans have taken to the streets of Miami in solidarity with the Cubans back on the island. And we saw, for example, that, you know, the Palmetto was blocked for a few hours with demonstrations. But, you know, there's a concern, and some people are saying, wait a second, there's the new anti-riot law, which doesn't allow you to block traffic. Is there a concern that, you know, we're breaking the law, or that police are going to have to start arresting people?
Yeah. So we have a very good police department. Director Freddie Ramirez was on the phone with me immediately when this situation arose. The highway is a Florida Highway Patrol jurisdiction, and he reached out immediately to the Florida Highway Patrol, provided backups. It was up to the Florida Highway Patrol to decide how to handle that situation. In the local streets, which are my jurisdiction, we worked with community groups to make sure that traffic could flow so that peaceful protests could continue. And I want to assure everyone that that is how I will function, regardless of the group. I believe in our Constitution and our First Amendment rights. I've been part of protests since I was a high school student myself, and I want to be sure that people are allowed to freely protest as long as it's peaceful. And we can work with them. We always have. We have a great tradition of working to protect our demonstrators. So that's how I'll be, no matter the cause.
You know, Mayor, to finish up, when you first took office and we had you on the program, we talked about your plans. You had a big plan on how to deal with COVID and the issue of gun violence on the streets and affordable housing. But, you know, you come into office and all of a sudden you have the Surfside tragedy. You have, you know, all these issues in the Caribbean taking place, kind of forcing you to reshape those plans. How have you adjusted?
Well, Lewis, we're continuing with all of those plans. You know, yes, we have crises, and the Surfside one is unprecedented, something that no one could have anticipated and breaks my heart each and every day. That to be said, we have our peace and prosperity plan. We had our Operation Summer Heat. And you might notice that we have not had a violent incident in our community since we launched those efforts. So I feel that we're making great progress there and a great commitment from the commission to work on prevention. As far as COVID, we beat the rest of the state. We've got over 76% of our over 12-year-olds vaccinated. And that is keeping our rates lower than the rest of the state. And we're pushing on. We have not given up on our COVID vaccine outreach. As far as housing, that is definitely an Achilles heel for this community. We are putting together aggressive plans. I've just released the proposed budget for next year, as well as the American Rescue Plan. All of it includes increases in housing affordability programs.
Well, I hope to have you back soon so that we could talk about some of those other programs a little bit more detail. But again, I really appreciate the time. I know that with everything that's happened, you have been extremely busy. Mayor, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lewis. A pleasure.
And again, that's Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava. I do want to correct something earlier. I said that the death toll was at 94. It's at 97. And again, there's still some that have to be identified and still some who are unaccounted for at this time. But you can keep up to date on the Surfside tragedy on our website at WLRN.org. Well, still to come, how have condominiums gone so long in South Florida with such little oversight? And is that going to change? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The Surfside tragedy has woken people up to the reality that there are a lot of condo buildings in South Florida that are aging and they're lacking oversight. The Sun Sentinel recently published an investigation with data showing how many condos in Palm Beach and Broward counties are over 40 years old and have not been recertified. Palm Beach County leaders are trying to change that. We're joined now by two of the Sentinel reporters in that investigation, Mario Ariza and Spencer Norris. Mario and Spencer, thank you so much for the time. Mario, I want to start with you. What are the rules for inspection throughout South Florida, and why are they different from county to county?
Hey, Lewis, thank you so much for having us on. So it's important to note that there's only two counties in Florida that require that buildings over 40 get recertified and produce this recertification inspection report. And it's Miami-Dade and Broward. In Miami-Dade, we started doing this in the 1970s after a building that was a DEA office collapsed because they were parking cars that they'd taken from drug dealers on the roof. And in Broward, we started doing this in the early 2000s. So those are the two counties that require this report.
And they require what, a 40-year mandated electrical and structural safety check, right?
Correct, yes. So you got to have an engineer go and kind of knock on the bones of the building and check for anything, any cracks and stuff like that, any spalling, which is a concrete term that we've all learned recently. And then you also have to check that the mechanical and electrical portions of the building are up to date.
Now, in Palm Beach County, this may change, right? I mean, because of the Surfside tragedy, they're now talking about changing those rules and how they inspect buildings, correct?
Yeah, correct. In fact, on last week's commission, Palm Beach County Commissioners and Mayor Dave Kerner actively discussed looking into how to create their own 40-year certification programs for buildings, all buildings in the county over 40 years old.
Spencer, you know, looking at the data that you collected, I mean, it's a little bit frightening when you think about how many buildings in South Florida are getting up there in age. But I wondered, what were the specifics that you wanted to gather? What were you looking for specifically?
Sure. And thank you, Lewis, again, for having us on. We were just looking for anything that could tell us a little more about the state of South Florida's housing stock, and specifically condos, of course. So we wanted to know, first and foremost, how these buildings were, how often inspections were being done, and code was being enforced, that kind of thing. Basically, we wanted as complete a picture as possible of condo safety in South Florida as possible.
And was it easy to get that data?
You know, it depends. So we had to go to a bunch of different locations in order to kind of get the data that we needed. And even when we found it, it was imperfect. We had issues with getting the exact locations of certain buildings, and we would have to enter that manually. So it depends is what I would say. At the end of the day, we weren't able to include Miami-Dade because we had some concerns about the data that we were provided with. But we were ultimately able to draw some things out of the data regarding the ages of buildings in condominium projects.
Yeah. All right. So looking at what you did find again in Broward and Palm Beach counties, how many condo buildings in Broward are now over 40 years old?
So at this point, we filtered the data down to condos with about 50 or more units. Just to make sure we were talking about larger locations. But in Broward, there's 412 condominium projects that are 4 years old. And in Palm Beach County, it's 483, again, with 50 or more units.
Okay. All right. And Mario, do we know anything about the conditions of those buildings?
So we're still trying to learn as much as we can about the conditions of those buildings. We're pulling records. We're hearing tips. We don't necessarily know a lot because we're still working to gather data from special masters and unsafe structures boards across the two counties in order to get a sense of, you know, when and if violations have been issued against these buildings for building codes or if they've been referred to authorities, these special masters and these unsafe structure boards for not correcting those violations.
Yeah. Spencer, if someone goes to, you know, with the data that you gathered, if they want to find out more about the building they live in, I mean, so how would they do that? And what information will they find?
Sure. So if you go to the map that we put up on Sun Sentinel's website, we're going to be able to tell you certain things about your condominium project. We'll be able to tell you the age of the oldest building. We'll be able to tell you the height of the largest building. We want to clarify that our map will be able to tell you about the condominium project as a whole. Again, this was a limitation of our data. We often weren't able to break it down by building. But certainly we'll be able to get you this information about each project. Kind of the big picture thing that we want to point out with the map, and I think the real value of it is showing kind of the development patterns in South Florida over a period of time. The map clearly points out that a number of the oldest buildings in Broward and in Palm Beach are located along the shoreline, where they're going to be more susceptible to the effects of climate change and sea rise over time.
Yeah.
So it was just kind of looking forward to how a lot of these older buildings are going to interact with the changing world.
You know, and I wanted to ask both of you this. Spencer, I'll start with you. Is there anything that was surprising from the data you gathered?
I think that one thing that was surprising to me about the data that we gathered was the existence of some of the data. So at one point, I think it was Mario actually found this. It was a list of all of the buildings by year that were coming up for their 40-year inspections. Mm. And this, yeah, Mario, do you want to talk more about this?
No, go for it. Go for it.
Okay. Well, apparently the county, apparently Broward County sends out this list every year to each city within the county, telling them exactly which buildings are going to be coming up on their 40-year recertification. The issue was that in many cases, it appears that the cities then notified the buildings that they needed to recertify, but for various reasons, they didn't follow up when the building failed to actually do so. So the data tells us that even though the cities were told where they would need to look for recertifications, they sometimes just didn't see the process through.
So just so I understand, the county is telling the cities, these are the buildings now reaching that point, that 40-year mark, and there needs to be a recertification, and it's up to the city to do the recertification. But are you telling me they didn't go through with it or they couldn't?
It's up to the individual buildings to go forward with the recertification. What I am saying is that in some cases, the city would notify the building, tell them your 40-year certification is coming up right now, and that's where the process would stop. It would not move forward after that point in certain cases.
Again, we are looking into a recent Sun Sentinel investigation in the lack of oversight on the condo industry in South Florida, talking with two of the reporters on that investigation, Mario Ariza and Spencer Norris. And you can check out their story, and again, check out that map. So you could see where a lot of these condos, older condos, are in Broward and Palm Beach County. Just find it on our social media, WLRN Sundial. So, Mario, I mean, a condo needs recertification. They're told by the city, but then it stops there. So who's held? How do you hold anybody accountable? Is it basically saying that the condo can just ignore whatever the city's asking for?
Well, not quite. In some cases, we found examples of condominium associations that went through and, you know, submitted the various steps of paperwork to get the recertification and got the recertification approved, and then forgot to pay the $600 fee at the end for the city. So they're still technically not recertified. And in the lists, they ended up being, you know, marked as not recertified. So there's various steps along the process of recertification where a building can fall through the cracks, so to speak. And it seems that cities, depending on the city, had varying levels of enforcement when it came to making sure that a building wasn't dragging its feet. And some buildings actually have been working on the recertification for 15 years, 16 years at one point. We've got an example in there.
Why does it take that long? You're talking about a $500-$600 recertification fee, but you have to have that inspection. Why is it taking that long?
Well, sometimes condo boards get replaced and a new board comes in and wants to do things differently. Other times there are rather litigious disagreements between condominium boards and the engineers or the builders that they hire. Sometimes, as we saw in the Surfside tragedy, boards will prioritize certain repairs and not others. And as long as a work permit is active with the city, they technically don't run out the clock on this recertification process. They can also, in Miami-Dade County, for example, just apply for a 6-month extension on recertification and pay $500.
And how many times can you apply for that extension?
I don't know, actually.
Again, because, I mean, you're telling me that there are some buildings that are going years without getting that the recertification. Spencer, what does the data tell us about the conditions of these older condos? Or do we not know?
Well, it paints a picture, but an incomplete one is probably the way I would put it. It clearly shows that Broward and Palm counties are dealing with aging condominiums and that a great number of them are clustered along the shoreline. But what we don't know right now is exactly how many are awaiting their 40-year recertifications, how many are past due on their 40-year recerts, and what risk factors each is subject to. I mean, we're hopeful that additional reporting will answer these questions in time, but I just don't have an answer for you right now.
What have you heard from readers after this investigation came out? Because, I mean, as we do the reporting too on this, is we hear a lot of people come forward and say, hey, I'm seeing problems in my condo building. Some of them, they may be small, but some of them, I mean, people are posting pictures. Some of these cracks or breaks, seem pretty serious. But what are you hearing from readers?
Right. So, we've heard a blend of things. We certainly have received plenty of tips related to condominium buildings with situations that readers have been concerned about. To be perfectly honest, we've mostly had our heads down working on a couple of projects related to this. And I have kind of had the blinders on for the past few days.
And Mario, I mean, what about politicians? I can only imagine. I'm wondering what you've heard from any of them in any of these communities, any of these cities, after this tragedy that's gotten international attention, there's pressure. There's got to be pressure, right, to do something?
Yeah, and I think y'all have reported on this, and so have we. There's been a spasm of enforcement that has occurred across the region. City building inspectors are scurrying off to look at buildings. There's audits being performed of the 40-year recertification program in Broward County and the various cities. Palm's having this discussion, of course. And I think that city building departments are in many cases swamped with complaints from citizens worried that, is this crack an issue or what's up with my pool? But in general, one difference that we're seeing is that officials in Miami-Dade have been willing to certify buildings as unsafe to occupy. I think the count is up to 4 or 5 at this point of buildings that have been declared structurally unsound. We're not necessarily seeing the same thing happen in Broward, but it's also not clear if Broward buildings have the same problem.
Where does this story go next, or what's the next level for the two of you? What are you gathering now, or where do you need to go next?
Well, I think you're going to have to read the Sun Sentinel to find that out.
Okay. Well, again, looking at the data that you collected, it's fascinating to see, again, just to have a picture of how many buildings, in the area, in our region, have reached that 40-year mark. And I don't want to make it sound either like a 40-year-old building is unsafe and dangerous, but the question has to come up is, how many of these buildings are getting that recertification? And again, Spencer, going back to something you said, I don't know if that's just part of the next step for you, and what more data can you gather to make those maps even, more useful?
Yeah, right. Like I said, we're in a situation where we don't have a complete picture of how many of these buildings have attained their 40-year recert, how many have any kind of issues that would need to go before an unsafe structures board or anything like that. We have small kind of windows into those issues for specific cities. But again, this comes down to the fact that a lot of this data is spread out across a lot of different municipalities. Each city is responsible for handling its own inspection process. So it's a question of collating that data across a pretty big geographic area. And we don't have that right now.
Again, Spencer Norris and Mario Reza, two reporters with the Sun Sentinel working on an investigation looking at Broward and Palm Beach County. How many condos in this region, are now over 40 years old? And is the recertification process changing now, especially in Palm Beach County, since they had very different rules? But you can check out their reporting again on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Spencer, Mario, thank you so much. I really appreciate the insight.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lewis. Appreciate it.
And by the way, stay in touch with us. Join our Sundial Text Club because we want to hear from you. If you live in a condo building anywhere here in South Florida, what do you see? What's going on? What are the conversations within the condo association about safety? Are you looking at things differently now because of the Surfside tragedy? Just type the word hello to 786-677-0767. Again, just type hello to 786-677-0767. We want to hear from you on this story and dig a little deeper into what the situation is with condos throughout our region. Well, still to come, hundreds of teenagers in Miami are experiencing homelessness. How can we change that? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. We're going to talk about some of the most vulnerable in our society, young people who don't have a place to sleep. Youth homelessness is on the rise in the United States. The pandemic made things worse. Young leaders on this issue from across Miami-Dade County met yesterday for the HOMI Annual Summit, where they pitched ideas to help those who are experiencing homelessness. Joining us now is Deandra Joseph. She is on the Youth Voice Action Council of the HOMI Collective. Deandra, thank you so much for joining us.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me today.
Absolutely. And also joining us is Audrey Aradanas, the Assistant Director of Programs for Miami Homes for All. Audrey, thank you for the time.
Thank you so much for having me here today.
Audrey, I want to start with you. This summit that went on yesterday, what's the overlying theme? What was discussed yesterday?
How we as a whole community can come together and end and prevent youth homelessness. That's the whole point of the summit. How do we make sure that we uplift our youth voices, that they are centered, and that they're the ones leading the movement to end youth homelessness here in Miami-Dade County? And how we as a community can come together and say, okay, let's make sure that happens. And let's work together to build coalition, to address strategies, to make policies happen, and to make sure that our young people are really just leading this and making things happen, changing systems and improving services.
How did the pandemic impact youth homelessness? Did it make it really worse?
Yes, I do think that, with the pandemic, we know that there may be a significant increase of youth experiencing homelessness. And we know that when hurricanes happened, there was a huge increase of students experiencing homelessness within our school system. And so with the pandemic, we expect that this may also again, increase youth homelessness numbers here in Miami-Dade County. In 2021, we did the I Count Miami, which is a survey of young people experiencing housing instability all throughout the county. We were only able to count about 200 young people experiencing housing instability, but we know that's an undercount, and we know that there's many more youth out there that may be couch surfing, that may be doubled up, that may be experiencing housing instability in general and maybe sleeping somewhere not meant for human habitation.
And by the way, because we said homelessness, but you know there's also, as you said, housing insecurity. Just could you briefly clarify for us the difference?
Yeah, so when we think about housing insecurity, that just means that you do not have a safe and stable place to sleep. And I mean, Homes for All, we believe everyone deserves a safe and stable place to sleep, right? And so when we think about how many youth may be couch surfing, so they may be going house to house, couch to couch, sleeping with friends or distant relatives or other family members, or sometimes we even have doubled up situations where there are multiple families sleeping in one household. And sometimes that may lead to instability, right? It could take one argument or one issue that may have one family or youth out on the street.
Deandra, as I mentioned, you're with the Youth Voice Action Council. And one of the things that you do is you go into schools and you have conversations with youth about this housing insecurity, this homelessness. How do you approach teenagers on this issue? What do you do?
First, I basically give a definition of what is housing insecurity and what is homelessness, because, you know, many youth do not know that they can experience youth homelessness, but they don't know, you know, what it is until they're in that predicament and they think it's just a regular thing, but it's not, and it's not okay. And provide them with resources of where to go, how to get help, and what to do in that situation.
And, you know, we talk about, again, because you have homeless and you have, you know, teens that are experiencing that housing insecurity. How often do you run into teens who are homeless, who don't have any place to stay? They may be sleeping in parks. They may be sleeping in cars.
Yes, I have encountered with, you know, many youth in Miami-Dade County that's dealing with housing insecurity, housing insecurities or homelessness. And, you know, like, you know, some couldn't find help or some didn't know where to go. And, you know, around that time, I really couldn't like help them to provide resources or anything like that because I didn't know for myself. But now I do know. So now I can initiate where to go and what to do during that, you know, time.
And Deandra, what role does the school district play? Do they, I mean, what do they offer in helping these kids find some kind of security?
I would say like some schools don't know what to do, but I know for sure that most schools have a program called Project Upstart that helps students that's dealing with housing insecurities or homelessness.
So they have, some schools have a program there for those kids.
Yeah, called Project Upstart.
Mm. You know, both of you have your own stories. Audrey, I wanted to start with you. I mean, you've experienced this housing insecurity in your youth, right?
Yeah. So growing up when, you know, before I moved to this country, I myself was in a doubled up situation. And as Deandra mentioned, you know, I didn't know that was housing insecurity until I became an advocate for people experiencing housing instability, right? I didn't know that from my own experience. And when I first moved here into, you know, here into the States, I don't know if you remember what Brickell used to be like, but I lived in Brickell before it became Brickell, right? And so at that point, when I first moved here, I want to say that I moved around three times, right? Because we just could not afford where we were staying. And so it was just constantly moving around to be able, you know, to until finally we were able to be secure. And so that was my own experience. And I wanted to make sure that even though my experience is not the same as anyone else's, but or it's very similar to many people, but at the same time, I want to make sure that should things happen, especially with COVID-19, and the pandemic, and with everything going on, that my story, you know, does not happen again, right? Because when you don't have housing insecurity, when you don't have housing security, you're not thinking about, okay, I need to focus on my education. I need to focus on my mental health and my well-being. I need to focus on, you know, all these different things. You're not really thinking about that when you're thinking about, okay, where am I going to sleep tonight? Where am I going to go tonight? You know, am I safe? Do I have something? Is my family going to be okay?
Yeah, very hard to be a teenager and think about anything if you're not sure where you're sleeping or where that next meal comes from. Deandra, what about you? What, your experience with this growing up?
So growing up, I didn't have my mother and my father in my life. So I grew up with my grandparents. And until my grandma, I lost her to breast cancer in 2016. And then in 2018, I became homeless. You know, I was kicked out of the home. I was homeless for about a month. I was working, you know, I was always working. And I was, you know, sleeping in parks, sleeping in the streets and stuff like that, and wanted to find help. I was always in the library searching for resources in Miami-Dade County, which I did not find. So I was like, you know what, I'm gonna just save up for, you know, money to get a place, but it was I was like, you know what, that's gonna take a long time, knowing that Miami rent in 2018 was still high. So I was like, you know what, let me just, you know, still go to school. And once I became a Miami-Dade College student, I received help from Sandra Obus from Educate Tomorrow that helped me to find a place to get a better job. And now I'm advocating for youths that are dealing with homelessness in my same situation.
You know, I mean, I'm listening to your story and I'm just wondering, like, how did you do that when you're sleeping in parks, you're sleeping outside, you don't have a roof over your head, but you're trying to work and go to school and live a life? What do you think got you through it?
I think that having strength and not giving up, because in that time, I didn't want to give up. And I just wanted, you know, I knew there was something out there that was, you know, that could save me. But it was, you know, going to school that saved me.
Hmm. And, you know, just from your experience, and again, because you deal with, you know, young people, you know, how often do you see kids who don't have that strength? What happens to them?
Kids who don't have that strength, they either commit suicide or they just give up and just, you know, stay being homeless and don't ask for help and just be stubborn, you know, because they're afraid.
Hmm. Again, talking with DeAndre Joseph with the Youth Voice Action Council of the HOMI Collective, and also Audrey Aradanis, Assistant Director of the Programs for Miami Homes for All, and talking about this issue of youth homelessness and youth who are experiencing, housing insecurity. How many are out there who are suffering through this, struggling through this, and what are we doing to help them? What is the school district doing to help them? By the way, also just want to mention, because, DeAndre talking about kids who might find themselves in that situation and not know where to turn to. If you or someone is going through a difficult time right now and you need support, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is always available. And I want to put the number out there. It's 800-273-8255. Again, that's 800-273-8255. Audrey, I wanted to get a sense of, you know, what data we do have. I know that we always do a homeless count, and you said that you think that from the number that you mentioned earlier, there's got to be more. Does the school district help in any way in counting? What, I mean, where are we getting the number?
Absolutely. So every year, again, we do the I Count Miami in January, and we counted this year about 200 young people experiencing housing instability. The Miami-Dade County Public Schools Project Upstart, which is the McKinney-Vento liaison to our school district, they're one of our amazing partners, and they also count how many students are experiencing homelessness throughout the county through different schools that we have here, and they counted about 9,000 students experiencing housing instability. Again, these are not just youth that are on their own, but these are youth with families. So there are 9,000 students in total, about 9,000 students experiencing housing instability on their own or with their families. And we know that about 300 of those students are on their own. So that means that they do not have a parent or legal guardian. At HOMI, we focus on youth that are on their own. So again, that just means that they do not have a parent or legal guardian with them. So DeAndre mentioned that, you know, we want to make sure that young people who do not have that support system, who do not have parents or have people that are there for them, that we connect with them, that we're there for them, and that we're connecting them to education, to employment, permanent connections, and housing. And, you know, all of this work, you know, we're so grateful for partners like Educate Tomorrow, the Homeless Trust, and the Children's Trust, honestly, for making sure that we are working with young people and that we are working with our school district and many other partners to bring all of our services together to support youth.
And as I mentioned, you know, again, the HOMI Collective held its annual summit. DeAndre, what kind of ideas came out from this? I know there was one about a drop-in center. What's that all about?
The 24-hour drop-in center would be a center that help youth that are experiencing homelessness in Miami-Dade County. Basically, it would have resources, beds, Wi-Fi, computers, case management peers, helping them find jobs, helping them connect them to schools and other services that's in Miami-Dade County.
Mm. And Audrey, I mean, any other ideas that came from this summit, or what are some of the things that have been discussed in the past, ideas that we're still trying to find a way to implement?
Absolutely. And so one of the things that we really want to make sure that we're thinking about is how do we change our systems and improve services? And one of our wonderful YVAC members, Lexis, shared, how do we make sure that our different systems like jail, police, school districts, the homeless trust, the foster care system are sharing data with each other, potentially sharing data into a warehouse, a data warehouse, so that way we can make referrals and connect youth more quickly to resources and services. Another idea, several ideas that came about was, how do we make sure that we're connecting youth to mentors? I think that's one thing that many of our young people have shared, is that, you know, when you don't have that support network, how do you connect with other peers or adults that say, hey, I'm here for you, or I'm going to connect you with, you know, get you further into your career, support you socially and emotionally, these sorts of things. And another idea was, how do we increase youth entrepreneurship to really build confidence in our young people? Those are just some of the ideas that they talked about, as well as creating an online portal system where, you know, as you know, with COVID-19, everything has been pretty much remote. But how do we make it easier for young people to know, okay, these are all the different programs that exist. This is the eligibility criteria, and this is how I can get started, to really make all of these resources and services available to our youth readily. And so those are just some of the ideas that we talked about just yesterday. But some other ideas that we're talking about in HOMI is, how do we make sure that we're increasing access to education? We have, you know, Florida is one of the few states in our country that has a state tuition waiver. Any student experiencing housing instability or is coming out of the foster care system can go to higher ed or secondary options for free. So how do we make sure that we increase access to that waiver and connect you to those kinds of educational opportunities?
There are
just some of the things that we're looking at in HOMI.
Yeah,
sorry, go ahead.
There are a lot of opportunities out there, a lot of resources out there. That is a very good point. Let me finish with this. I want to ask both of you, Audrey, I'll start with you. Is how do you reach out to, you know, a teen who's dealing with homelessness or housing insecurity? Because sometimes, listen, there's a lot of shame involved. I don't need to tell you. You know, you have to try to reach that child and let them know there's no need to be shamed and there's help. Audrey, I'll start
Absolutely.
With you on that.
Yeah. Absolutely. We partner with amazing agencies that actually do this outreach. But first and foremost, our YVAC. Deandra leads our outreach and engagement committee. And what they've done is they totally revamped the HOMI website and our social media to make it more youth-friendly. So that way, should you Google us, HOMI in Google or anywhere, our website shows up first. And they can see that this is where I can go for help. But other things that we do is actually do that on-the-ground outreach. Through iCountMiami, for example, our YVAC members actually went out in the streets and started engaging youth on the streets and asking, hey, do you have safe and stable housing? And one of our YVAC members actually supported a young person in accessing shelter that same day. So those are some of the quick ways that we want to make sure that we're engaging young people experiencing housing instability.
Yeah. And Deandra, I'd imagine that, you know, you have your own personal story that can help inspire. But you know, what do you say to young people and to help them take that first step?
I would say, you know, to let that shame go and know that you are homeless and that you do need help. And it's okay if you think that they might not help you, but they know somebody that knows somebody that will help you.
The help is out there. You just have to ask for it sometimes. Again, I want to thank my guest, Audrey Aradanis, Assistant Director of Programs for Miami Homes for All, and Deandra Joseph. She's part of the cohort of the Youth Voice Action Council of the HOMI Collective. And again, they had a summit recently, and you can find out more about them on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Audrey, Deandra, thank you so much for sharing your stories. And again, just reminding people that there is a lot out there, a lot of help out there if you look for it.
Thank you so much. You have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you again. And that is our program for this Thursday, July 15th. Sundial Senior Producer is Chris Remington. Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Odalis Garcia and WLRN intern Kristen Moorhead are helping produce this week. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. And WLRN's interim program director and technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. Our theme music, by the way, is from the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Palo at gopalo.com. You can download this podcast, by the way, just search WLRN Sundial on our podcast app. Well, coming up next week on the program, Surfside hired a renowned structural engineer who investigated the 9/11 attacks to help uncover what could have led to the condo's collapse. He's going to join us to talk about what he knows so far. Plus, more of the latest coming out of the unrest in Cuba and the aftermath of the Haitian president's assassination. And don't forget, you can always follow any of our stories or segments. Just go to WLRN.org. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great Friday. Have a wonderful weekend. Stay safe. Be good to each other. We'll talk to you again live on Monday. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.